You're listening to 95.7 FM, KDRT LP, Davis, California.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you.
And that music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore.
And this is Lois Richter on an overcast, windy winter day in Davis.
It has been wild weather in California since we last spoke to you folks. During last week, there have been some unbelievable rainfall totals here in Northern California. We got in the last 2-3 days about 3 inches of rain in the Vacaville, Davis area during that major storm that hit the state that, of course, was all over the news. The brunt of that storm in Southern California, but we did have wind speeds here in Northern California, 40, 50, 60 miles an hour. Power was out all over Northern California to residents. We were very fortunate in our area that we had very few power outages. And Southern California, I was just sharing the screen with Lois to show her some of what they were dealing with down there. 10, 12, 13 inches of rainfall in a 48-hour period in the mountains behind Los Angeles. I grew up in San Diego, California, where the average annual rainfall is about 10 inches. Yeah. Annual rainfall. Now, San Diego didn't get hit with the brunt of this particular storm, although it is still raining down there as we speak, I believe. It was Los Angeles, and then the coast up from Los Angeles and Big Sur and Northern California, San Francisco Bay Area got a lot of rain as well. But really, the main force of this storm hit Southern California.
If you're saying it was 13 inches of rain on the mountains,
mm-hmm.
Well, rain runs downhill.
Yes, indeed.
Wash away a lot of stuff?
Oh, there's been major flooding down there, landslides, all that kind of thing. Pictures of the Los Angeles River cresting its banks and the Santa Barbara area. And Los Angeles itself got 8 or 9 inches of rain, I mean, downtown. So these were unbelievable totals. This was I don't know if it set records. It probably did for the date. They're still cleaning up from it down there. Here in Northern California, the Bay Area got a lot of rain. Wine country, Napa, Sonoma counties, 4 to 5 inches on a lot of the peaks around the wine country area. So we had a lot of rain. It was warm. So there are some interesting implications of that for gardeners. Let's talk about the upcoming weather. Are we out of the woods on this? Well, we're recording this on Wednesday, February 7, 2024, for broadcast on February 8, 2024. And that day, it will be 51 degrees. It's cooled off quite a bit. We were about 10 degrees warmer as a lot of these storms were coming through. This is tropical air, atmospheric river, classic Pineapple Express phenomenon. So we're going to cool off rather dramatically compared to what we've been having. In fact, tonight, Wednesday night, is going to be 37 degrees. Thursday, 51 is going to be the high. Thursday night, partly cloudy, 36 degrees. This is a little more important here. Friday, 54 is going to be the high, mostly sunny. Friday night, mostly clear, 38 degrees. Saturday, 58 degrees, sunny. That'll be pleasant, but cooler than we've been experiencing. Saturday night, mostly clear, 37 degrees, but patchy frost.
Frost.
Patchy frost is in the forecast for, looks like, Saturday morning, Sunday morning in particular, and possibly even Monday morning, although they're backing off from this a little bit. Now, the temperatures are only going to be, you know, the recorded weather station temperatures, 34 to 37 degrees. So there'll be visible frost, but we're not talking about anything that's going to do significant damage to outdoor plants. But it's something to be aware of, that we're going back into a colder pattern, or what you might call a more normal pattern, as we get through the storm. If you go to the extended discussion, there's some real uncertainty right at the moment. But the Sunday through Wednesday, a ridge seems to be progressing to dominate. When I say ridge, you know that means high pressure, no rain, sunny, you know, the opposite of what we've been going through with troughs. Well, ridges are sunny and troughs are rain. However, there are some short waves, as they call them, some small storm cells that will move through that ridge at times. but they look pretty weak and they're far north. So most likely it'll just be up in the northern part of the state. They're not calling for rainfall here in the Sacramento Valley, but these are unstable. And a lot of what we were experiencing during the storm was sudden episodes of unstable air mass dumping. I mean, an inch of rain in just an hour or two in places like Woodland. So we could have some of those. Don't count on no rainfall over the next few days, but the pattern is towards ridging with high temperatures getting close to or even slightly above average Sunday into Wednesday. Let's just talk about the gardening aspect of this a little bit. People have been coming in to buy dormant spray for their fruit trees. It doesn't really do it.
Are they still dormant?
Well, that's the first question. No, in many cases, some of the peach varieties, which is the key thing people are concerned about, peach leaf curl is what they want to spray for. They're breaking buds in many cases. The varieties differ as to when they push out of their dormancy, but many of them are breaking buds, in which case it's too late. It probably, by the time you're able to get out there and spray, they will be past the stage where the copper spray will prevent the peach leaf curl. Probably. Depends on the variety. You can certainly look yourself and see any sign of green or any hint of color on the flower buds, green on the leaf buds, color on the flower buds. It's too late for the spray to make any difference. If you spray and it rains within 24 hours, it probably won't make much difference. So again, we're going to have another year where peach leaf curl is going to be very hard to manage by prevention via spraying. As I've said many times before, in our area, peach leaf curl does not significantly affect yield, does not significantly affect fruit quality. There may be areas where it does, but it's not the end of the world if you can't get the spraying on. There's not much point in spraying your tree if you can see bud color. I just want people to understand this. We have a fairly narrow window for this to be effective. The material isn't all that effective anyway. Hate to say that, but it's true. And so you may just have to ride this one out. Keep the trees as healthy as you can. It might be, as with last year, appropriate to fertilize them as the growth begins in the season to try and get them to outgrow the leaf curl faster. Water correctly, of course, as we get into the irrigation season. Most people's peaches and nectarines came through last year's serious bout with peach leaf curl okay, but my own observation, and I hate to dump on this rootstock, but my own observation was the trees on a regular rootstock outgrew it like normal. The trees on the semi-dwarfing rootstock Citation took 4 to 5 weeks longer to outgrow it. So my concern on that is really simple. If you have trees on Citation, it's not the end of the world, but you should make sure that you don't allow interior parts of the tree to be exposed to direct sunlight that would not ordinarily be exposed to direct sunlight because of lack of density. I hope that sentence made sense. If the leaves drop and it's not growing out real well, the interior branches can get sunburned. Sunburn on an interior branch of a peach or a nectarine tree or other types of fruit trees, but these are our main concern right now, can get sunburn, and that can lead to borers and can lead to the death of that branch. And that's sort of the beginning of a decline process for peaches and nectarines. If it looks like that's going to happen, there's absolutely nothing wrong with whitewashing that interior, just getting some interior white latex or tree trunk paint and whitewashing parts that you're concerned about. More to the point, keep the trees healthy. And it may be, although I don't typically fertilize my fruit trees much once they're established, it might be appropriate to put a couple of pounds of nitrogen on a tree. We can talk about the rates of application if that's something people are interested in. Main thing is monitor the trees and make sure that they're growing adequately so they can outgrow the peach leaf curl.
Two questions pop up as you're talking. One is, if I'm going to go and paint my tree, I'm going to get a little sprayer, mix things up and go, because it's a lot easier than using a brush. Mm-hmm. Do I have to worry about the buds?
No, that's the good news.
They get sprayed?
No, if you're using an interior white latex, water-based type paint, that's not a concern. The buds will just push right through it. We don't recommend enamel paint, although I had a customer who did that once and it pushed right through, amazingly. Again, I don't suggest that. But it may not be anything to worry about. It could just be that we'll have a more typical pattern with leaf curl, which is even in a bad year, other than last year, even in a bad year, you get a whole lot of leaf infection. And then the tree pushes through and outgrows it. And many of those leaves drop, if not all of them. Last year, 2023, we had a significant primary infection. And then it just kept raining and it was cold. So not only did it continue to reinfect, we had secondary and even third tier infections that were continuing to affect the tree for 3-4 weeks. The plants were growing more slowly because of the lower temperatures. That was unusual. So hopefully this year, I expect we'll have very high percentage of leaves affected initially. If we have anything closer to normal weather patterns with less constant rainfall and with more average type temperatures, the trees will probably outgrow it. I've done this many times to just illustrate this, where I take my camera out on a tripod and I set it in one place where I frame a certain number of portion of the tree and I mark that spot. I take a picture and I go out and I do the same thing in that exact same spot 4 weeks later. In a typical year, even if I've had 80% or more leaf infection, 4 weeks later, it's mostly gone because the tree has outgrown it. Last year, it was more like 6 to 8 weeks, and that was on good rootstocks. So on a less vigorous rootstock, they were looking pretty sparse all the way into June, unfortunately. Again, if we have a problem with fruit set, as with last year, it was because of lack of pollination, because the bees don't fly when it's raining and cold. It wasn't basically the leaf curl. But hopefully this year we'll have some sunny weather while the trees are blooming and we'll get more fruit. That would be wonderful.
So my other question on what you were talking about is, if someone has gone and gotten the spray, mm-hmm. but can't spray, or it's already broken buds and you don't yep. want to spray, will that chemical or that material hold for another year? Can you just hold it and use it next year?
The main product people are using for leaf curl and other fruit tree diseases is a liquid copper spray. There's two forms, a copper soap spray and the more common one is called liquid cop. Both of those have good shelf life. 3 to 5 years is reasonable. Some of the older spray materials that people would use, like lime sulfur in the old days, 1 year they'd settle out and solidify, so you had to use them up that year. Fixed copper sulfate, if you still got some of that in your garage, went off the market 10 years ago, but you might still have some. Fixed copper sulfate was a wettable powder, and as long as it stayed powdery, it was still fine. So if you still have some of that, much more effective than the modern copper sprays, that's for sure. But yes, it does keep, and that's a key question there is, if you didn't do it this year, okay, well, hold on to the stuff and try and get it on next year if you choose to go that route. I don't want to say hi to some friends out there, because I think this is a nice relevant point for that. We've got some listeners in Fredericktown, Missouri. Welcome to the Davis Garden Show, and I always love to look up where that is, and it's in mining country down there in the Ozarks. The pictures online are absolutely beautiful. They must think that we're having a fun time here with the rain, because this kind of rainfall, I guess, is not that uncommon down there. 46 inches of rain is their average. Oh. And they're in, and they get about 9 inches of snow as well. They're in zone, USDA zone 6 or 7, depending on whether they're uphill or downhill. Always good to know where you folks are listening. And I thought that might be a timely segue into where we are in spring here in the Sacramento Valley. So you can adjust your listening to what we're going through. In other words, where are you with respect to daffodils blooming?
So we always do announcements, and this time we have a catered alert. And that is that Tony Brusca and Paul Zinn, who are members of the Nickel Slots, will join host Jim Buchanan on the program Live Tracks for KDRT Friday, February 9th, beginning at 7 p.m. And they will be playing live at Morgan's Mill Cozy Concert Series in Woodland. The series is a four cozy concerts with duos taken from various groups around town, and it has been organized by leftofthedialpromotions.com.
Well, I want to mention that UC Davis Distinguished Professor Emeritus Art Shapiro won his own Beer for a Butterfly contest that he launched.
He usually does.
This is unusually late in the season, yeah. I think, for this. I'll have to ask him at some point. He launched this contest in 1972 as part of his scientific research. No competitors came forth at the Bohart Museum of Entomology collection point. By the way, we've often mentioned the UCANR blogs and so forth. They have a Facebook page. Right. And it has a lot of this stuff on it, and some great pictures by Kathy Keatley Garvey, who is a phenomenal photographer, appears to manage that page. And she does a lot of their blogging as well. It's got a pencil handy. UC Davis Department of Entomology and Nematology. I got a funny thing that comes in my email blast. Go ahead.
Wait. We got one more announcement.
Oh, yes.
Valentine's Day is coming up. It's February 14th. And the UC Davis Botanical Conservatory is having an event. They say, we are excited to present our Valentine's Night at the Conservancy, at the Conservatory, Botanical Love Plant Reproduction Talks. That sounds like it's going to be fascinating. Join us next Wednesday on February 14th at 6 p.m. at the Botanical Conservatory for a series of talks and learn about orchids, like the vanilla orchid, and the many different pollinators, such as fly pollinators, and interesting ways pollination can happen. Free and no RSVP is needed. All are welcome to attend. Spaces will be limited, so try and come early. All right, there you go.
Yeah. UC Davis Conservatory, we used to just call them the botany greenhouses when I worked there. It's an amazing collection of plants packed into these old-fashioned giant glass greenhouses. If you haven't been there, I suggest you check it out. Well, I got one of these funny emails that I get. I'm on all kinds of ag email lists, and this is actually a nursery industry one that overlaps a lot with that. Glow-in-the-dark flowers get USDA okay. This is from Grower Talks newsletter, Acres Online, column by Chris Bates. So you're always asking me, says Chris, what's new? Well, tell me if this is new enough for you. Bioluminescent petunias. Meaning petunias that glow in the dark, on their own, genetically, without paint or dyes or artificial means of any sort other than genetic modification, that is. You know, when I was a student, this is me editorializing here, genetic modification was going to be the wave of the future. It was going to save humanity. It was going to feed the masses. It was going to create more nutritious food. But instead, we're getting glowing petunias. This novel introduction, which those other things are happening too, whatever you think about GMOs, but this is the kind of thing that entertains the public. This novel introduction, which will be sold under the name Firefly Petunias, is coming from the synthetic biology startup Light Bio of Ketchum, Idaho. Formed in 2019, Light Bio is a pioneering synthetic biology startup focused on cultivating vibrant bioluminescent plants through the melding of proprietary technology and advanced genetic engineering. Light Bio worked in collaboration with Ginkgo Bioworks, which describes itself as the leading horizontal platform for cell programming, in a nutshell. And in plain English, Chris continues, Firefly petunias get their glow from DNA that comes from various species of luminous mushrooms. They figured out how to genetically enhance the natural luminescence or glow of the fungal genes by many orders of magnitude. These enhanced mushroom genes, when inserted into other plants, cause those plants to glow. The luminescence is self-sustaining through a metabolic and synergy with the plant. This enables perpetual illumination without any external aid. You don't have to charge the petunias with sunlight, like a watch face or something. Through testing, they found that petunias provide the brightest bioluminescence, especially in the flower buds. So the Firefly Petunia, which will be launched in April of this year. Light Bio is now taking orders for finished plants at www.light.bio. During the day, they look just like a regular white petunia and require no special treatment or care. At night, they give off an ethereal aura. Light Bio says they've got 50,000 plants available for purchase on their website, can be shipped to all 48 contiguous states in the U.S. Now, we don't usually talk prices, but I'm sure that's the first thing you're asking yourself. How much will it cost? Okay, $29 for a 4-inch pot. So you're probably asking, are these things legal and safe? In the eyes of the U.S. Department of Agriculture, they are. Last September, USDA determined that their genetically engineered firefly petunia may be safely grown and bred in the United States. This milestone, says the CEO, and the magical experience we are bringing to people across the country has been decades in the making. So this is just the beginning, he says, working in collaboration. Light Bio anticipates that future plants will be at least tenfold brighter. My God. More plant varieties and more colors are also envisioned. And in addition to the pure joy these plants bring, the underlying science also helps to elucidate the molecular physiology of plants. Okay, I know what you think about painted poinsettias and dyed roses, says Chris. Can't wait to hear what you have to say about glowing petunias. Okay, we'll see how that goes.
The thing that you read was from where?
This was from Grower Talks, which is one of those magazines that nursery people get. It's, you know, industry-funded magazine. And Acres Online is the column. Chris Bates, a longtime writer for these sorts of publications. You see him at all the trade shows and so forth. He's great. He likes to go find the new stuff in the business. Glowing petunias coming soon to some garden center somewhere. Who knows when?
Okay, so Thank you, Don, for that great and enlightening reading of this article. It was, it was glowing.
It glowed, yes.
So, but
do we give that petunia? Broadly, do we give that petunia a glowing review?
Oh, you're shining bright today, Don. So, aside from glowing petunias, it said that there were naturally bioluminescent mushrooms.
Indeed.
Oh, that's cool. Did you know about those, Don?
Yeah, you just actually can type that into Google and you'll come up with some amazing
pictures. So here's my question to you. Bioluminescence, it's got the word bio in it. Does it mean that once the mushroom is plucked, it no longer glows?
I would assume that the process shuts down because the whole metabolism of the plant shuts down at that point. So anyone out there that's been plucking bioluminescent mushrooms, please let us know how quickly it fades.
Okay. Well, you know, I'm looking at this picture that they have, and it's in the dark, and there's this woman holding petunias, and it's this green glow on her on her front.
I'm not sure whether I want this in my own garden, honestly, but it should be fun, and there's certainly a market. The question also comes up: are there any GMO plants in the nursery industry? And at the present time, the answer is basically no. But there is a genetically modified tomato plant with purple flesh that's coming on the market this year. You'll probably see it in stores at some point, and the plants will probably be available, although probably rather pricey. What they've done is there's been purple tomatoes with purple skin forever, but the flesh was red or, normal orange color. These are vividly purple fleshed. I mean, not as bad as the Photoshop things you see when the ads pop up on your Facebook feed, but definitely distinctly more purple. And that's been created by genetic engineering. That will be, if it comes to market as a plant, the first GMO, if you want to call it that, genetically engineered vegetable plant or food plant that home gardeners would be able to get access to in the United States, to the best of my knowledge. There's been one in Japan for a year or two that has enhanced nutrition, higher content of certain vitamins. The company that made that one decided to give away seedlings by the thousands to introduce this idea and try to create a positive attitude about it, since genetic engineering can be controversial, but that's not available in the United States at this time. And there's been some confusion about this purple tomato. All you got to do is look up purple tomato and you'll get confused. Baker Creek, which is a seed company that stresses that they only sell heirloom and open pollinated seeds, started running ads for a purple flesh tomato. About the same time, we started seeing news feed articles about this purple flesh genetically modified tomato. No company that's doing organic or heirloom or open pollinated seeds would do a genetically modified plant. Genetic modification is anathema to organic. You can't grow GMOs if you're an organic farmer or gardener. But they were talking about apparently a purple flesh tomato that's been introduced by Oregon State by conventional breeding. They don't have the seed. They've taken down their article on this subject and removed it from their site. They were hoping to have seed this year, but this was coming. I was getting confused questions from people because they saw this one and then the articles about this genetically modified purple fleshed tomato. Both are coming on the market roughly at the same time, and one of them's a GMO and one of them isn't. So we'll talk more about it as we get more information about those. Meanwhile, you can focus on bioluminescent petunias.
So, Don, we were talking about it's too wet to get out there and spray. We've talked about that a couple times. And here we have an old question that's still relevant, particularly in our wet winter this year. James writes, I was wondering if you could help me with a couple questions about soil. First, what does it mean to damage soil structure, such as when it's too wet? What is the physical mechanism and what is the end result for the garden? And then a second question, in preparing a new vegetable bed in adobe-ish soil, is it okay to break up the hard clay soil and mix in some compost or other amendment, or should I really just top dress with the amendment? I worry the seedling roots will not be able to penetrate the hard clay. I also want to remove as many Bermuda sorrel bulblets as possible. What is the best approach? So let's do the second one first, because that's going to be a lot shorter.
Yeah, and I want people outside the area to understand that we have soils here with fairly fine texture. We have generally, if you're lucky, like Lois, you have sandy loam. If you're other parts of town, it's a silty loam, which is where I am. Silt is a smaller soil particle than sand, and many parts of Davis, Woodland, Dixon, as you get further out from the rivers, interestingly, you have clay loam, which is an even finer textured soil. And the finer it is, the easier it is to hard pack it and have adverse impacts from that. So if you're listening in an area where you got nice, loose, loamy soil, you know, gravel and leaf mold, that kind of thing, well, don't gloat, but you should feel fortunate. I have a quick story. I went back, my grandmother owned property in upstate New York, and we went back there to settle her estate, and I was the teenager who was interested in gardening. There were a whole bunch of seedlings that she had started. She liked to start wildflower seeds and seeds of the shrubs and the daylilies that were growing on the property and things like that, and just plant them out. We got there, and she had died, and all these seedlings were out there. So my job as the glum teenager who didn't want to hang out with the rest of the family was to go out and plant these somewhere on the property, just get them in the ground. It was my last tribute to my wonderful grandmother. And I went out, and it was pouring rain the whole time we were there. Okay. If it were pouring rain here, I wouldn't be able to do anything. Not only would I be slipping and sliding around, my shoes would be getting stuck and would be pulling off my feet as I walked, and trying to do anything in the soil would be like moving soup around. There, I just took a trowel, stuck it in the gravel and leaf mold that constituted soil, pulled it back towards me, dropped the seedling in, flumped back in the gravel and leaf mold mix that they called soil, and I was done. Didn't even have to water them. So I understand there are many places where people are listening who might be mystified by the notion that soil structure can be seriously damaged by digging in it when it's wet or walking on it when it's wet. It has to do with the mineral content of our soils here and the type they are. When you rototill soil, the simplest problem is it breaks up the capillary movement of water until the soil particles can re-aggregate. And this is damaging to the network of soil mycorrhiza, to beneficial organisms that we now know. If you took soil science 50 years ago, you might want to brush up on it. We now know are very important to the plant's ability to take up water and nutrients. And you're breaking that up. These mycorrhiza vastly expand the functional surface area of a plant's root system. They are in and on the roots. They expand outward. They take in water. They take in nutrients. You've broken all that up when you go through with a rototiller. Working it when it's too wet, and this is really the key thing when it's literally this soupy soggy out there, compacts the zone where you are digging on the sides where the shovel penetrates, as well as just below the point of mechanical action. So right there, you'll have a slick surface that stays that way. Repeatedly doing this, digging or tilling your garden every year, can actually create a compacted zone of soil just below the dug zone. Or, you know, if you're disking like a farmer, you get a plow pan down there where it's just compacted below the equipment. You can do the same thing in your garden. An area with fewer air spaces, probably less air exchange, that can adversely affect the movement of water and make it harder for roots to penetrate. We don't know exactly how long that damage lasts. We presume it's variable, depending on the soil type. The finer the particles, the more clay you have, the longer the damage would be. A soil scientist commented at one point that the damage to the structure in the soil organisms probably lasts a couple of years. So if you have reason to believe that your soil needs organic material, as James is suggesting, well, first of all, a soil test would be useful. You could send your soil out and they'll tell you what percentage organic material you have and whether that's high or low or whatever. Some people find they can analyze the texture themselves, and you can go online and find ways to take a bunch of dirt and shake it in a jar of water and see how it settles out. And that will tell you what kind of soil you have and how much organic material there is. But it is not uncommon at all for people to want to turn in some organic material when they first create the garden bed. It's not unreasonable because you want better soil texture for working. You know, you want the seedlings to be able to get out of the soil so it doesn't crust over and so forth. But from that point on, let's say you've done it that first time, you're turning a bunch of stuff in. Okay, that's fine. You've done some damage to the soil structure, but it'll recover. The best thing to do is just keep adding organic material on top of the garden bed afterwards. It will go in and incorporate itself at the rate that is determined by your population of soil organisms, including earthworms, which are there, they're present, and the local temperature and soil moisture and so forth. You will watch farmers routinely till the surface of their farms when they're row crop farmers, where they're direct seeding. They're just trying to make a local zone of loose soil to get better seedling germination. They also have rather different goals than do home gardeners. Soil that's been in row crops for many years can develop that plow pan, that zone of compaction. That doesn't really matter to the grower. They can just rig up a deeper plow and break that up if they wish to. But they're growing all of their plants in the roots of those plants in that shallower zone. They're applying a lot of water and a lot of nutrients And they're managing it that way. If they convert row crop land to orchard, you'll very commonly in this area see them bring in a specialized deep ripping plow to break through that plow pan. And that's what you probably don't have an easy way to do that in your own garden. You will find in your garden, your soil become more friable, one of my favorite words, suitable for seedling germination just by adding organic material on top. So the simplest, instead of trying to direct seed into soil that's heavier, is to transplant seedlings into the soil. And your soil texture will improve over time as you add organic material on the surface. You can direct seed some things, big seeds, beans, corn, melons, squash, pumpkins. That usually works even if your soil is fairly dense. Finer seeds, you may need a seed bed that you've created separately, or again, start them separately and transplant them in, or of course, buy them at local garden centers. That's the concern with this constant tilling and digging and so forth, is that you're creating you're harming layers of soil in different places. You go out to dig a hole to plant a bare root fruit tree right now, you'll slick the side of the hole and the roots will simply not penetrate rapidly out into the surrounding soil. They'll circle in the planting hole. So that's obviously not desirable. You want to wait until it's not just slicking on the side as you dig the hole. My rule is I take a shovel out, put it in the ground, pull it up, flip it over, and if the soil drops down crumbling or at least breaking apart, I go ahead and plant. If it falls in one big glob of mud, I'm doing more harm to the soil than I want, and I simply don't plant. But what this really comes back to is just getting out there and doing stuff in the garden. These are all reasons we don't want to walk on saturated soil unless we really have to. We would take measures to redistribute your weight on the soil. Let's say you have a garden, you want to get out there and pull weeds. Walking on the soil is harmful, so drop some boards down to redistribute your weight. You know, have 2x4s, planks of plywood, whatever it takes, so that you're stepping on them rather than stepping one place after another on the soil and compacting it there. Dedicated paths made of fine bark, refreshing the bark. The arborist wood chips are even better. A good plan if you have access to those, because it'll reduce compaction. And in the case of the wood chips, they'll steadily decompose. Bark takes longer. But in either case, some organic surface material can turn into paths and then you can walk on it periodically. We at our nursery, we use shavings because we have livestock bedding that we use for the bare root fruit trees. When the season is over, we just spread them out over the nursery. It looks great, makes a great walking path. So it doesn't matter that much what it is. It just determines what they are, just determines how quickly they're going to break down. So there are some plants that are particularly good at breaking up soil, soil, and it's those that have strong adventitious roots, which means grasses. So if you have a real problem with compacted soil and you want to build the soil the natural way, you simply seed in grass cover crops. And sometimes they're mixed with peas and things like that to fix nitrogen for the soil. There's a great combination out there of field peas and oats. So that's an excellent one. Annual ryegrass does a very good job. Their roots are very aggressive and they will break up the soil very quickly. And as we've often mentioned on the show, if you then just cut them down or chop them down as you get closer to planting season, those roots will disintegrate and build the soil in their own right. So cover crops with fast-growing large taproots like mustard or radishes can even break through zones of compaction that you might have inadvertently created by some of your previous practices. Fava beans make large root systems. When they break down, the decaying roots create those macro pores or channels that allow water to penetrate deeper. All in all, it's much better for the soil to naturally build it and improve the organic content if you have a reason to want to do that. But yes, the very first time you have my permission to rototill in some organic material or manure or whatever you want to try and make a more workable surface, bearing in mind that everywhere you've gone with that tiller, you've broken up the soil mycorrhizae, you've broken the soil structure, you've damaged the soil structure. But here's the other thing about rototilling, usually only going about 4 or 5 inches deep. You know, most people think that they're going a foot or more deep. No, you're just making essentially a seed bed. If you prefer to cultivate, you've probably seen those little handheld power tillers out there. Mantis is a brand that's out there. They're really just cultivators. Okay, that's fine, because you can just take that right down a line where you're going to direct seed something, seed right into that. That'll restore itself pretty quickly. It's the rototilling the whole garden and tilling in the organic material year after year after year that does have some adverse effects. And most especially right now, given that it's bare root fruit tree season, it's too muddy to plant. We've said this over and over to people. Go out when you can dig that hole. We'll hold your tree at our nursery. I'm guessing many garden centers would do that. We'll hold it until you've got the hole dug. Don't take it home. Plan to go out and dig a hole and then find you can't for 5, 6, 7 days. If you have to do that, the garden center should wrap the roots in, put some shavings in there around them in the bag that they send them home in, or in many cases, they're putting them right in soil nowadays. A lot of garden centers are just directly planting up fruit trees and roses as they come in, in which case you're good. You can just wait until you can dig a hole before you go out and plant that thing. But don't try and plant. And in our area, with our denser mineral soils, it's usually at least 5 to 7 days after a significant rainstorm before the soil becomes workable again. So maybe next weekend, maybe the weekend after. It's not the end of the world. The bare root season may end quickly, but nurseries almost always have those reasonably good selection in containers on into the spring.
Well, we have a question from Ragby saying, "Dear Don and Lois, I need help with the goal of growing a citrus hedge that would extend above our fence to provide more privacy in the backyard, and also as a part of my plan to have fresh fruit year-round. I got 2 very small mandarin trees and 2 orange trees that were a bit bigger. The 2 mandarins have both grown in the same way. Rather than continuing to grow from their already established trunks and branches, they sent up new vertical trunks that start from very low on the main trunk. These new sprouts have a stem that is smooth and green, unlike the more established part that has a rough brown bark. But the new, quote, trunks, unquote, also have wider diameter and have grown twice as tall as the original growth. I would prefer to grow these trees with just 1 trunk each. Which trunk should I keep? When is the best time to prune? I'm attaching pictures of the 2 trees." Oh, my.
Good pictures, because okay. They illustrate a very important principle. And you will, we leave this situation on the plants frequently at our garden center when we see it, so that we can show the customer when they buy the plant. What is growing upright on your mandarins is rootstock. And the way I can tell from the picture is that it has a 3-part leaf. So the most common rootstocks of citrus that you're going to encounter nowadays are trifoliate rootstock, 3-leaf rootstock. It's a sour orange. I have lots of it on my property because in some places I've let them grow and they can turn into lovely trees, but the fruit of that rootstock is not your mandarin. It's very sour and rather bitter. I mean, I have one that's a great big beautiful tree because where it came up, it's lovely and it flowers like crazy and I like it, and it sets hundreds of fruit which just mold in the ground cover beneath it. We keep thinking there's got to be some way to use these. And I said, no, some people make marmalade from it, but it's not even as good as a Seville orange for that. So what you have there is going to take over your tree if you don't remove it. So go down to where you'll find the graft scar on the stem, which is usually an angle graft. You can see just a line going at an angle on the stem, usually 6 to 12 inches up above the ground if the tree was planted at the right depth. These are coming up from below that for sure. Cut them off completely clean all the way to the trunk. When they're young, you can just break them off. So when we first see these flush up on our plants at our garden center, we just snap them off with our thumb. It's very easy. They're very easy to tell apart if you happen to have this particular rootstock, because it has 3 leaflets on a leaf, and your mandarin doesn't. So that part is pretty easy. They're also generally rather thorny, to put it mildly, and they grow much more vigorously than the top, so they will completely overtake the top. And more than once, I've gone to look at a citrus tree that wasn't producing well and then started producing and the fruit was no good. And I get there and I have to say, look, here is your original grapefruit or whatever down here, this one little branch. The rest of your tree is all rootstock. And that's, you know, 3, 4, 5 years into the process, probably too late to recover the main part. Right now, though, you're in good shape. You can see them. You can see where they're coming from. Cut those off clean and your mandarin should start growing. The rootstock is taking all the energy at the present time and you should be good. Mandarins do grow more slowly than oranges, so that your hedge will be a little variable in height. You should get 1 to 2 feet of growth on a mandarin in a season, 2 to 3 feet or more on an orange. Regular fertilizing starting, let's say, in about March with a citrus food, or basically nitrogen is what you're after. So look for something like that. Citrus food are fine. They have extra sulfur and extra trace elements in them. Feed them every month or so during their first couple of years, from, let's say, March to August or September, and you'll get more growth on that. And you want to focus on growth while these are young. You're not really looking for fruit production yet. I generally stop fertilizing my citrus, if at all, by the 3rd year. I go by the plant performance, but I generally find that focusing on growth for 2 to 3 years, then backing off on the fertilizer, and the plant is probably going to be fine on its own. But wherever you're listening, that may vary a little bit. I just think that it's good to primarily focus on growth, and also monitor, wherever you're listening, monitor real closely for root suckers, because that's what you're looking at. Those vigorous shoots are root suckers. And you should be able to find their point of attachment, cut them off clean. It'll still be easy to do. So you have an easy answer to this one. Those aren't what you want. Cut them out.
A couple of questions, Don. The question about when is the best time to prune, it's my understanding that citrus, it doesn't really matter. You can prune anytime.
Don't do it in freezing weather. And the only reason for that is an open pruning wound would be, at least hypothetically, more subject to freeze injury. We generally prune in the warm season. I like to do this citrus if I'm pruning it right after the bloom. They bloom in April, so I just get up there after that's done. But yeah, pretty much anytime. Don't do hard pruning in the middle of a heat wave. Don't do significant pruning during freezing weather. But it's not a specific time of year as it would be with deciduous trees, where people try to do it in the winter or in the late summer. Citrus can be clipped and shaped anytime, and people are often afraid to prune citrus. There's no reason to be scared about it. People want trees that stay small. The true dwarf rootstock that was around for a long time, Four Winds Growers pioneered that, which was one of these trifoliate varieties. It was just a particular rootstock. It's gone. They're not using that anymore for a number of reasons. So you can't get a truly miniature citrus. You can get varieties that grow more slowly, like Meyer Lemon or Mandarin. You can get varieties that get bigger and prune them. And you can control the size. It's just easier to do that from the start. I have mandarins on the property that I've had now for over 30 years. Yeah, I've taken pictures of them sometimes. Some of them, when they were first in about their third or fourth year, I kind of took the center out to get them to spread out more and become more rounded. These are Satsuma mandarins. Those are about 8 feet tall and about 8 feet across. Same variety, nearby, same irrigation system, unpruned. I just let them go as big as they wanted. They're right on the county road, so people can steal the fruit if they want to. More than 15 feet tall and more than 15 feet across. And so that's bigger than most people want, particularly for mandarins, because you have to cut the fruit, not pull it. Did you know that? Because if you pull it, it tears. If you cut it, it'll store. So, you know, in my case, I did it just because I was okay with it. But you, about 3 to 5 years in, control the ultimate size and shape of your citrus tree by either taking out the center or not, and by how you prune it thereafter. Once a year pruning would keep it any size you want. Once you get them up the hedge size you're after, that's fine. Every couple of years is fine for most people. It's not something that needs annual pruning, and it's not complicated pruning. It really is kind of just pruning it like a hedge. So I hope this works well for you. Just take those root suckers off as soon as you can.
So Don, I've got a question, but it's sort of convoluted to get there. So okay. Bear with me. We were talking about whitewashing a part of a trunk on a tree so that the sun doesn't make the borers and all that sort of stuff. When you do that and you're using latex paint thinned down, mm-hmm. and you put it on there. Now, that paint's going to stay there for a while. Mm-hmm. And I'm assuming that at some point the bark will get thick and it'll flake off or something. But does putting that white latex paint on a tree harm the tree?
No. And it flakes off within a year or so. Yeah.
Okay. So the answer is no. Yep. So here's my thought. And this is where that I got convoluted. We were talking about having things, suckers come up from below the graft, yep. on a citrus tree, but that would be true of any tree that's grafted. So yes. Here's my thought. When you buy the tree and you see where the graft is, why don't you just paint everything below it white? And then you'll be able to tell really easily where things are coming from.
The graft union, graft scar, is quite visible for years, for actually the whole life of the tree in most cases. You can see where almost any grafted tree has been grafted. Some of them, it's really distinct, like English walnut on black walnut, there's a color change. But almost every grafted tree, it's very easy to see where that graft scar is. So it wouldn't be necessary to do what you're doing. It might make it easier for you to see a root sucker when it comes up. There's no harm yeah. to doing it. Yeah. So there's no harm to using an interior white latex thinned out and painting it that way. We had a customer when we had a pruning service who had a male and female kiwi grafted on the same vine. And that was a pruning complication because the male vine grows about 30% more vigorously than the female vine. The female is the one you want for fruit. So we had to prune the male part more vigorously than the female part. Now, how are you going to tell that apart? Well, they were butted down on the stem, and this customer took enamel paint in this case and just put a bit of enamel paint at the base of where on the branch that was the male part. And so we looked at that, we'd get there, go, okay, little color code that one, this part of the vine, we prune harder, we leave the rest less pruned or virtually unpruned in the case of the female part. So it's okay to use a little enamel paint on your tree. It's fine to use white interior latex on your tree. It does flake off within a year or two. So that would be the only drawback to what you're suggesting, is that it will of course fade away or flake off. But knowing where that graft scar is really important. In the case of some other types of trees, the rootstock isn't that significantly different in appearance than the top. So a lot of the peaches and nectarines and things that you buy, you're not going to be able to look at a leaf and say, oh, this is rootstock. In some cases, it's a different color, but for the most part, they look pretty darn similar. In the case of the citrus, in the case of the trifoliate orange, this listener has, it's very visibly different. It's got a three-part leaf instead of a single entire part leaf. So that's quite obvious, but in some cases it's not. So it is important to know where the graft union is. Also very important that graft union be up and out of the ground. So when you're planting, hopefully they give you some instructions at the garden center where you bought it, where the root flare is, and that should be visible. And if you do that, the graft will be 6 to 12 inches up above the ground anyway. But I have had people send me pictures of trees they planted and they buried the graft union. Now there may be places where you do that. I don't know. I know that with roses in some places, it gets cold enough that they intentionally bury the graft union, for example. So I don't want to pretend I'm talking about what's appropriate in, let's say, New York State. But here, and most places, I believe, the graft union should be up and out of the ground and it should be visible. You should be able to see where it is. Nothing wrong with marking it with something that makes it more visible, and watch for root suckers on any tree that's grafted. That goes for almost all the fruit trees you buy, with a few exceptions. Figs, pomegranates are generally on their own roots. Persimmons are grafted. All the stone fruits are grafted. Apples and pears are all grafted. Most of the citrus, I mentioned the exceptions, Meyer lemon, Mexican lime, slime may be on their own roots, but might be grafted. So it's important to know and to monitor for that, because rootstocks are often chosen for their vigor. They're chosen for how rapidly their roots grow, but also if they happen to send up a shoot, it can be, in many cases, more vigorous than the tree that you actually planted. I realize a lot of people don't realize that the fruit tree they're buying is actually two plants. The scion, the one you paid for, the navel orange or whatever, and the rootstock. And just knowing where they're put together is the important part. Also, if you really have good eye-hand coordination, learning how to graft and bud can be a very fun hobby. So you can get all kinds of varieties on your own tree. You want a multi-graft tree? You can do it yourself. Rather than paying a lot of money for it, just learn how to bud or graft.
So Don, it is the first week of February.
Yeah.
And
the time to plant tomatoes?
What? No. But is it time to plant tomato seeds? How about talking about seeds? I know that you came up with an article about a sequence of when you put in seeds of certain varieties or certain species in order to get the plant to the proper size when it's supposed to be planted. So can you run through that for us?
Yeah, we got a lot of people buying seeds and mail ordering seeds, and they're arriving and they're coming in to buy their seed starting stuff. And the one guy said just a couple of days ago, he felt like he was a little late for tomatoes. Late? Well, if you don't know how long it takes to get from seed to a transplant size, and that could be a valid concern, because we're at the stage right now where peppers and eggplant, you better get them going, because they take a really long time from germination to a transplantable size. You're not going to put them in the garden until about the first week of May, but it may be that long since you don't have a heated greenhouse or growing lights or things like that. Peppers and eggplant can be very slow. In fact, they're very frustrating to a lot of us who grow things for sale, because you'll start them in January, February, they come up, they're going great, and then they just sit there and they stall, mainly because they want warmer night temperatures than we can provide without having a heated greenhouse. Tomatoes, by comparison, you start them, they come up very quickly. Within about 2 weeks, they're ready to shift into the next size container, and they are 4 to 6 inches tall within just a few weeks. So you'll end up, if you start them early, that's fine if you want to, but you'll end up with really tall plants. You'll end up with plants that are 3 or 4 feet tall. That's okay. Drop them down deeper, but there is no need to do that. So at our garden center, and for our own production and my own purposes, we start peppers and eggplants in January and February. We use heating pads, special pads that you put on the bench underneath the flats, which keep the soil temperature at least there at about 70 degrees. That makes a huge difference. We use grow lights as soon as they come up, because the light intensity indoors is just not enough for seedlings. They stretch really badly otherwise. And they go outdoors into our little pop-up greenhouses if it's sunny, or outside into a sheltered location if it's cool, if it's not too cold at night, but it's very important to keep them warm at the roots. So we end up shuttling things in and out a lot when we're talking about peppers and eggplant. They will take about 10 to 12 weeks to be big enough to plant out in the garden. We have shifted them typically to 4-inch pots early in that process, and that's what they'll be transplanted out into the garden from. Tomatoes, we start here, USDA Zone 9, Sunset Zone 14. We plant seed in March, and we continue planting seed in through April for later sales of seedlings. But for most avid gardeners who are champing at the bit, 1st of March, okay? They go into 4-inch pots in about 4 weeks after germinating. So by the end of March, first part of April, they're going into 4-inch pots. And again, as we'll tell you repeatedly on the show, we don't really recommend planting them out in the garden until about the 3rd week of April, until the soil temperatures are warmer. You know, we go through all that, and you've heard it before, and I'm sure we'll go through it again. But this is really the key thing. It's okay to start plants early. Just keep them moving, by which I mean, if they're getting root bound in the pot they're in, move them up to the next pot. So if you start them early, they'll be very tall, very gangly when you plant them. That's okay. You can just plant tomatoes deeper. But if the roots are really bound up when you're putting them in the ground, that can really set them back. So if they've gotten root bound in the 4-inch pot, if the nights are cold, if the soil temperature is not where it needs to be, personally, I'll shift them from the 4-inch pot to a gallon container in good quality potting soil. So I am generally planting out in my garden plants that are 3 feet tall but have a nice, well-developed root system. They go in the ground 3rd week of April at the earliest in our climate. Early May was more appropriate last year. Really, soil temperature is the big thing. So, of course, we talk about that a lot as we get closer to that time. The other thing he wanted to plant was, go ahead.
Before you get too far gone, I'm hearing you say that if I planted, you know, 2 dozen seeds of tomatoes, or 2 dozen of those little planter things there, the little tiny things are like 2 inches across. And then as they grow, I'd have to put them into 4-inch pots, and then have to put them into gallon pots. And 30 tomatoes in gallon pots, where the heck am I going to put those?
On my front porch. And this happens every year. So that's what serious tomato gardeners do. Here's the thing. If you just backed off on planting a couple of weeks, the 4-inch pots are a very reasonable way to go. Planted from seed in mid-March, either directly into 4-inch pots or then transplanted into 4-inch pots, those plants 5 to 6 weeks later will be ready to go in the ground. And that would be 3rd or 4th week of April. Now, I know there's folks out there that plant in March, and I argue with these old guys every year, and that's fine. You're welcome. You should be starting your tomatoes now, then, if you want to plant them in mid-March. You also should have your devices ready to cover them and keep them warm and all that kind of stuff. I'm talking about low-input gardeners here, you know, people who want to grow tomatoes but aren't trying to be competitive about it. But you make a good point. I'm telling you, it's great to put them in 1-gallon cans. Yeah, I have an area on my farm somewhere near the front door, out on the driveway or something, where there's 20 or 30 1-gallon tomatoes sitting there. Then I don't have to worry about it. You know, if it's like last year when it was really delayed because of temperatures, when there's any kind of adverse weather, or I just can't get them in the ground because I'm too busy or whatever, they're in a 1-gallon can. They've got a nice, healthy root system. I don't have to worry that much about it. So I can put them in the ground whenever I feel like it. And I'm getting a plant in the ground. It's pretty well established. It's 2 to 3 feet tall, as I always joke. I can drop them in past the gopher zone and I'll have better results.
So Don, you've talked about peppers and eggplants and tomatoes. What other kinds of things would you plant from seeds, and when would you do that?
Well, a gentleman who was asking about the tomatoes and thought he was late also wanted to plant cucumbers and squash and melons and things like that. They're really fast to germinate, and they don't like cold soil. They need very warm soil, and particularly melons, but the others still. We plant those at our nursery to sell beginning in April. And we can sell plants. This amazes us every year. We can direct seed them into a 2 or 3-inch pot and sell the plant 10 days later. They come up that quickly when the temperatures are good. And if you plant them too early, they sulk. And if they're root bound, they really struggle. So this is a case where I get frustrated with my fellow nursery professionals. Root bound pumpkins, root bound squash, root bound cucumbers don't transplant well. The plants sit and sulk for a couple of weeks. Many times they never really grow out of the root-bound condition. It would be better to buy young, healthy, just baby plants than further along plants. But of course, garden centers and hardware chains can't keep constant monitoring of the plants that are out there and throw out the ones that are overgrown. Sometimes people like the idea that they're buying a nice big cucumber plant and then they put it in the ground, just sits there. It sulks for a couple of weeks while the roots try to get out. So I would wait till much closer into planting time on those. Cucumbers, melons, squash, we'll plant them outside within about 3 weeks of seeding them, which means mid-April is a great time to start the seeds, and we continue seeding them all the way into May. The ones that really need warm soil and you definitely shouldn't even bother planting early are okra and watermelons. Those need soil that's 60 degrees plus, 65, closer to 70 degrees would be better. We don't even start the seed until mid to late April here in USDA Zone 9, Sunset Zone 14, and we're planting those outside around Memorial Day weekend. So try not to start seed too early. I understand the temptation. People are already posting great pictures of their little seed trays of tomato seedlings, and I'm thinking, wow, and you're going to keep those in little pots for 3 months. If you do start them early, keep transplanting the seedlings, which raises Lois's question, where are you going to put them? And do be prepared to bring them back into the house or into at least a sheltered greenhouse if the nights get cold again. So this is an issue that you'll have to shuttle them around. I remember 3 years ago, I had 42 flats of peppers I was taking in and out. I wanted them outside for the sunlight and the air movement. I wanted them inside because the nights were too cold. 42 flats of peppers every day, in and out. Home gardeners are probably talking about a flat or two, so this is not that difficult a practice, but very, very important to get them out into sun and air movement if you can, but back in if the nights are anywhere below about 50 degrees. So wait on these heat levers until much later in the season. And just for the record, seeds of basil, well, you can do that anytime if you're going to try and grow it indoors, but basil, sunflowers, bush beans, corn can be planted anytime from mid-March to early April all the way into late June, and some of them even later. I should mention beans, kind of a special note. We've had pretty bad results with regular garden beans here in the valley for the last couple of years because they don't take the heat. And they would grow fine, flower, and then the seeds are they're blank. They don't have beans in them. So I am finding that my best results with beans are early in the season. So let's say starting the seed in mid-March, planting them out as early as possible, getting your harvest done by the end of May or early June, or planting again in about August for that fall harvest that you get. Go ahead and try them for the summer, but don't be surprised if the heat that we get here, our typical heat, just reduces yield. So overall, that's one that you could go ahead and start a little earlier. But I really want people to not be frustrated. So I would suggest holding off on planting most of these things, except if you're listening now and you're in a climate zone like ours, peppers and eggplant, because of how long they take.
What medium do you use? You just dig up some dirt from the garden and seed in that? Or what do you do?
We use 50-50 peat moss and perlite, which is a great combination because it naturally contains very few nutrients, and you don't want to have a lot of nutrients around seeds as they're sprouting. It can lead to seedling diseases. We want essentially sort of naturally sterile media. So 50-50 peat moss and perlite has worked well for us. If you don't want to use peat moss, you can use coir, which is available at some places. Some people seed directly into coir or directly into peat moss. We like the faster drainage that you get with the 50-50 mix of peat and perlite. And then as soon as they're sprouted and rooted to the bottom of whatever little cell they're in, they transplant into the next stage. Anyone who really gets into doing things from seed typically has seedling flats with these 50-50 mixes of their own preference. And as seedlings come up, they have special little tools that look like little tiny trowels, but a teaspoon or a tablespoon will work just as well to tease those individual seedlings out and gently put them into the 4-inch or quart pot. Water very carefully at that stage. We go from a seedling mix to a regular potting soil, water carefully, and they'll root in rapidly. You've been listening to the Davis Garden Show with Don Shore
and Lois Richter here at KDRT LP 95.7 in Davis, California.